Well, do you ever find yourself thinking that the challenges and troubles and trials of life are things to be avoided? Pain avoidance is usually pretty high on my list, but you know what's interesting is that in Romans chapter 5, the Apostle Paul makes a truly remarkable statement. He says this, he says, "We also exult in our tribulations. We exult in our tribulations, knowing that tribulation brings about perseverance, and perseverance proven character, and proven character hope, and hope does not disappoint, because the love of God has been poured out within our hearts through the Holy Spirit who was given to us." It's the same idea that James expressed in James chapter 1 when he called us, called upon us to count it all joy when we encounter various trials. So why should we exult in our tribulations, as Paul teaches us? You know, why should we count as joy that the trials that we go through, as James says? Well, it's because the tribulations of life, it's the trials of life that God uses to build our character. That's the means, that's the tool that He uses to refine us, to grow us, to mature us. And it's through those tribulations, it's through those trials that God builds our character by teaching us to depend on Him rather than on ourselves. And when we view it from this perspective, it's clear that our troubles are in reality an act of God's grace. We tend not to think of it that way, but when we're in trouble, when we're having struggles, when we're having difficulties, that in reality is an act of God's grace. Well, this morning as we continue our study of Genesis, we're going to see the same principle illustrated in the life of Jacob as he faced a great challenge. You know, since it's been several weeks since we left off at the end of Genesis chapter 31, I think it'd be appropriate just to recap a little bit about where we've been, because otherwise today's passage won't make all that much sense. So let me just back up a little bit. Remember back in chapter 27, we read about Jacob deceiving his father in order to steal the blessing that Isaac had intended to give to Jacob's twin brother Esau. You know, that's kind of the starting point of the events that we're going to be talking about this morning. And do you remember when Jacob did that, when he followed his mother's suggestions, his mother's schemes, and he stole that blessing from his brother? Do you remember what Esau's reaction was? I'll give you a hint. Turn to chapter 27. Look at verses 41 and 42. How strong was his reaction? Pretty strong, yeah. Chapter 27, verse 41, it says, "So Esau bore a grudge against Jacob." So this was not just a fleeting thought that he had. It was a grudge because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him. "And Esau said to himself, 'The days of mourning for my father are near.'" In other words, he's thinking that his father is old. He's probably not going to live too much longer. And, you know, for his sake, he's not going to do anything yet. But he's saying, "The days of my mourning for my father are near. Then I will kill my brother Jacob." Now, when the words of her elder son Esau were reported to Rebekah, she sent and called her younger son Jacob and said to him, "Behold, your brother Esau is consoling himself concerning you." How? By planning to kill you. Boy, that's some method of consoling, right? So obviously, serious situation, serious conflict between these brothers. And of course, it was at this point that Rebekah realized that it would be a good idea to get Jacob out of town. Time to get out of Dodge, as they say. And so Rebekah, as she so often did, she hatched another plan. She hatched another scheme. And she thought, I know what I'll do. I will go to my husband Isaac, and I will suggest to him that what Jacob needs to do is he needs to leave Canaan and go back to our homeland and there find himself a wife. So this kind of became a reason, you know, not just to get him a wife who was not a Canaanite, but really her motivation was to get him away from Esau so that he would be safe. And so sure enough, at Rebekah's prompting, Isaac called Jacob to him and instructed him to leave Canaan and to go to Padan Aram in Mesopotamia to take a wife from among the daughters of Rebekah's brother Laban. And you remember that. So Laban, of course, is Jacob's uncle. And this area that he goes back to, it's the area around Haran. Remember, that was the area that that Abraham had departed from when he headed to Canaan. Well, then one night, while Jacob was traveling through Canaan on his way to Padan Aram, Jacob had a dream in which he saw the angels of heaven were descending and ascending on a ladder or on a stairway. So you have this progression of angels coming down and going back up, being transferred between heaven and earth. That was the image that he saw in his dream. And in that dream, the Lord spoke to him and affirmed that Jacob was the recipient of the same covenant promise that had been given to his father Isaac and before him to his grandfather Abraham. So Jacob responded by acknowledging the presence of the Lord and by setting up a memorial in that place, which he named Bethel, which means the house of God. And he vowed at that point to return to Canaan after his journey. So he's heading out of Canaan, but he's vowing to one day come back to Canaan because the Lord has affirmed to him that he is the recipient of the promise that was originally given to Abraham, then passed on to Isaac. So Jacob goes off to Padan Aram, and while he's there, by God's grace, Jacob was able to find the household of Laban. And then because of Laban's trickery, he wound up marrying both Leah and Rachel. Remember, he wound up with two wives for the price of one, because he had to pay a double price. He wound up with two wives, and he worked for Laban tending his flocks for a total of 14 years as payment for these wives. And then the last lesson that we had a few weeks ago that Rocky taught, you remember that during that time the baby wars began, and the Lord blessed Jacob with 11 sons through these two wives and through his wives' maids. And then when that 14-year contract was up, do you remember what Jacob did? He went to Laban and he asked for permission for something. Remember what he asked him for? To leave. Yeah, what he wanted to do is he wanted to fulfill that vow that he had made to the Lord to return to Canaan. And he said, hey, my 14 years are up. I've done the work that was required of me in order to obtain these two wives. And now I am interested in heading back to Canaan. Well, what was Laban's reaction? Was he excited about the prospect of Jacob leaving and going back to Canaan? No, why not? Yeah, exactly. You see, Laban fully recognized that Jacob was under the blessing of God. And Laban had kind of had sort of the spillover from that. Laban himself had prospered because of Jacob being there. And so Laban was not at all eager to see Jacob leave. And so what he does is he pleads with Jacob and he says, Jacob, you know what? I really need you here to take care of the flocks. I really need you to continue working for me. Name your own price. Whatever price you want, you know, it's yours. And so that's when Jacob strikes this deal with him to take the speckled and spotted and mottled and striped sheep and goats and cattle. And anything that was a solid color would belong to Laban, and that way they could keep each other's flocks straight. And so Laban agreed to that. And you might remember that several years passed while they were living under that arrangement. And during that time, Jacob's flocks and herds grew very large. And guess what happened to Laban's? They didn't. And so there's some grumbling that takes place. And in fact, Jacob, he hears a report through Laban's sons that, you know, Laban's sons are grumbling that, hey, there's something fishy here, that, you know, Jacob's flocks are prospering and our flocks are not. And that report gets back to Laban, and Laban's response is he's no longer friendly toward Jacob. He doesn't know how Jacob is doing this, but he really resents the fact that Jacob is being blessed in this way, and Laban suddenly is not under any blessing at all. And so trouble was brewing. And at that time, the Lord commanded Jacob to leave Padan Aram and to return to Canaan. And so this time, instead of asking for permission, Jacob does what? He leaves. He just steals away. He packs up all of his herds and his flocks and his wives and their children and the servants that were tending to these animals, and his whole entourage slips away in secrecy. It seems like it'd be kind of hard to keep that a secret for very long, wouldn't it, when you have a group that's that large. Well, sure enough, Laban quickly figures out what has happened, and he did pursue Jacob and his family. And, of course, Jacob knew that when he did this, when he stole away in secret, that Laban was going to be furious with him, and he knew that it was going to be putting his own life in jeopardy. But remember what the Lord did in His grace? He appeared to Laban in a dream. And what did He say to Laban? Don't do any harm to Jacob. And so Laban has been warned by the Lord Himself not to do harm to Jacob when he caught up with him. And so Laban does catch Jacob. They interact. And kind of the bottom line is that they make a covenant and agree not to harm one another. And then Laban returned back north to Padan Aram, to his home, and Joshua and his entourage continued heading kind of southwest, heading toward Canaan. And that's where we left off last time, and so that's where we pick up at the beginning of chapter 32. So let's turn to chapter 32 together. Well, chapter 32, verse 1, it says, "Now as Jacob went on his way, the angels of God met him. And Jacob said when he saw them, 'This is God's camp.' So he named that place Mahanaim." I'll get it right. Mahanaim. So when was the last time that Jacob saw a company of angels? When was the last time that angels had anything to do with Jacob? You remember? At Bethel. Yeah, remember when he had that dream and he saw the angels ascending and descending. How long ago was that? 20 years. Yeah, it's been 14 years he worked to obtain his two wives, and then he spent another 6 years working for Laban, tending the flocks. And so it's been a 20-year period since he had any kind of an encounter with angels. Only this time it's not a dream. This time he apparently actually sees the angels. So, obviously, this incident seems somewhat reminiscent of that early experience. And what impact do you think this would have on him? Remember, he has left the land where he's been living with Laban for 20 years, and he's heading to the south and west, and he's heading toward Canaan, and en route, he sees this encampment of angels. How do you think that would impact him? How would that impact you if the Lord had commanded you to go to Canaan, and on your way, you saw a company of angels? Would you say, "Oh, that's nice"? A little hard to relate to. I mean, it's not something that we encounter every day, is it? But how do you think that might strike him? An affirmation. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that he's within God's will. He's doing what God has required of him. And the fact that God has angels present there would suggest to him the presence of God Himself, the power of God Himself represented in these angels. So God here again is demonstrating grace to Jacob, showing him this assurance, or giving him this assurance of His presence. And then, of course, he names that location Mahanaim, which means two camps or two companies. And that really affirms his understanding that, you know, Jacob has his camp, he has his company, and the Lord has His camp and His company as well. And so Jacob, by offering that name change of that location, is really affirming the fact that God has His angels present there with him as a great assurance. So again, it's important to note here the Lord's grace toward Jacob. Remember, Jacob is a man who's certainly not above using devious means to get what he wants. We've seen that a time or two, have we not? And yet the Lord is gracious to him. Remember, He protected him by warning Laban in a dream not to harm him. So that was one act of grace. And now, through this company of angels, He graciously affirms His presence with Jacob. And the Lord does good to Jacob, not because of Jacob's character, because Jacob certainly doesn't merit any favor at all, but He does this in spite of Jacob's character. Well, Jacob's next action comes as something of a surprise. You know the old adage, "Let sleeping dogs lie"? Well, that's not what Jacob chooses to do. When it comes to his relationship with Esau, he doesn't do that. Instead, he takes the initiative to be reconciled to his brother. And look at how the passage continues in verse 3. "Then Jacob sent messengers before him to his brother Esau in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. He also commanded them, saying, 'Thus you shall say to my lord Esau, Thus says your servant Jacob, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed until now. I have oxen and donkeys and flocks and male and female servants, and I have sent to tell my Lord that I may find favor in your sight. So here, what he's attempting to do is, after 20 years, to be reconciled with his brother. And he's taking the initiative to do that. Now, obviously, it's not an easy thing to seek reconciliation with anybody who's angry with you, is it? I mean, think about times when there has been animosity between you and somebody else. It's never easy to take the initiative in seeking reconciliation. And suppose the person who has something against you is desiring to kill you. You know, how difficult would that be to take the initiative to try to repair that relationship? So Jacob is clearly taking a risk here, but his desire to make amends with his brother is something that is good and right in this pursuit. And of course, it's at this point that things really start to get interesting. Take a look at verse 6. The messengers returned to Jacob saying, we came to your brother Esau, and furthermore, he is coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him. Now, what kind of a reaction? If you were in Jacob's shoes, your brother is bearing a grudge against you. He has made plans to kill you. He's just been waiting for Isaac to die in order to carry out this act. And Isaac has not died yet at this point. So, you know, presumably that grudge is still there. That plan is still there. Jacob is taking the initiative to seek the forgiveness of his brother. You know, that's what this message means in verse 5, where he says, I have sent to tell my Lord that I may find favor in your sight. That's the indication that what he's really wanting to do is to repair this relationship. And so the messengers go, and then they come back with word that, Esau is on his way, all right, to meet up with you. And by the way, he's got 400 men with him. You know, it doesn't exactly sound like a welcoming party, does it? So sure enough, look at Jacob's reaction. Verse 7. Then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, and he divided the people who were with him and the flocks and the herds and the camels into two companies. For he said, if Esau comes to the one company and attacks it, then the company which is left will escape. So as fear strikes Jacob's heart, what's the first thing that he does? These verses that I just read. What's the first action that he takes? He makes a plan. And what's his plan? Split up his people. Yeah. You know, he's got all these flocks and herds, and then he's got people who are tending to them as well. And he divides them into two parties so that if one is attacked and destroyed, at least the other will survive. You know, that seems like a reasonable course of action. But, you know, for somebody who is terrified about what is about to befall him, what might be a better course of action to do as the very first thing? Pray, yeah. And you'll notice he doesn't do that, at least not yet. But then you come down to verse 9. The first thing that Jacob does is he comes up with a plan. He takes action, which is so characteristic of his life. And, you know, what's interesting is that while he has certainly acknowledged that any success that he has enjoyed throughout his life, you know, anytime he's discussed that with anybody, he has acknowledged that it has been the blessing of the Lord that he has received. That's why he has so much. That's why he's been given so much. It's strictly the blessing of the Lord. And yet, his pattern has been to rely on his wits and his own strength. And we've seen that in his life again and again. And what's interesting is that if you go all the way back to chapter 28, when he has that dream and he makes that vow to return to Canaan, that from that point forward, during that 20-year span, there isn't a single prayer of Jacob that's recorded. Instead, what we see is he makes plans, he makes plans, he makes plans, and he carries them out in his own strength. Until verse 9. Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, O Lord, who said to me, return to your country and to your relatives, I will prosper you, and I will prosper you. I am unworthy of all the loving kindness and all the faithfulness which you have shown to your servant, for with my staff only I crossed this Jordan, And now I have become two companies. Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, that he will come and attack me and the mothers with the children. For you said, I will surely prosper you and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which is too great to be numbered. Well, what are some key points that Jacob expresses in this prayer? How does this prayer strike you? Does it seem like what he's praying here is good and reasonable and right? What does he say about himself? He's humble, isn't he? That's a little bit of a contrast to the Jacob we know and love. Yeah, he's really been humbled here, hasn't he? And you know, he acknowledges that he's unworthy, that everything that he's been given, he is totally unworthy. What else does he pray? What does he say here about the character of God? What things does he acknowledge about God? He's faithful. What else does he say about God? He's a covenant-keeping God. Yeah, he comes back to that promise, doesn't he? What else does he say? He's sovereign. He's loving. Yeah, you'll notice that he's extended his loving kindness. And there's an implication here that God is providential, that he talks about the providence of God. He doesn't use that word, but the fact that God has given him all of these things. And then he makes his petition. You know, and he's very open. He says, deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, for I fear him. I mean, he's just open about what is going on in his heart, about what he's thinking, about what he's feeling, and just appeals to God's goodness and God's grace. And then, of course, he comes to the promise, coming back to the promise. Lord, you have promised that my descendants would be like the sand of the sea. They'd be too many to count. And he appeals on that basis. Really quite a prayer. Not what you'd expect from a man who doesn't pray, or doesn't, at least from anything that's recorded here, no indication that he has been a praying man. But he certainly offers an appropriate prayer here. But then, you know, after offering this prayer, the next thing we see Jacob do is take action again. And let's continue with verse 13. So he spent the night there. So he prayed, and then he spent the night there. Then he selected from what he had with him a present for his brother Esau. 200 female goats, 20 male goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 milking camels and their colts, 40 cows and 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys and 10 male donkeys. He delivered them into the hand of his servants, every drove by itself, and said to his servants, pass on before me and put a space between droves. He commanded the one in front, saying, when my brother Esau meets you and asks you, saying, to whom do you belong, and where are you going, and to whom do these animals in front of you belong? Then you shall say, these belong to your servant Jacob. It is a present sent to my lord Esau, and behold, he also is behind us. Then he commanded also the second and the third, and all those who follow the droves, saying, after this manner you shall speak to Esau when you find him, and you shall say, behold, your servant Jacob also is behind us. For he said, I will appease him with the present that goes before me. Then afterward I will see his face, perhaps he will accept me. So the present passed on before him while he himself spent that night in the camp. Well, what's his plan? Now, obviously he prays, but then he takes action again. He develops another plan. And what's this plan? What's he going to do? He's going to butter him up. Yeah, how does he do that? With a gift? Little gift? Big gift. Yeah, anybody add up the animals? It's 550. Yeah, this is no small present. And how does he go about presenting this present to Esau? It's kind of interesting way that he does it. Did you catch that? Repetitiously, he divides them up into droves, so that as Esau is heading north from Seir, from Edom, and you know these flocks and their attendants are heading south, you know, first he would pass one drove and have this conversation, and then there would be a gap, and then there would be another flock or herd and another conversation, and then a gap, and this is just going on again and again and again. Pretty good plan, isn't it? I mean, it seems like if you were the recipient of the gifts, it would be quite impressive. Well, you know, is he doing this because God directed him to, or is he doing this on his own? You know, it's not entirely clear, but we do get a clue regarding his motivation. If you look at verse 20, what's Jacob thinking about as he makes this plan and then executes this plan? It's kind of what Jordan was saying. Yeah, he's trying to appease him. And, you know, so it sounds here like he's not really asking the Lord to change Esau's heart, but instead has again come up with a plan. You know, and that's not to say that there's anything wrong with offering gifts and making a plan like this. But I think at this point it's still a little bit unclear as to how reliant Jacob is on himself versus how reliant he is on the Lord. He kind of has, a foot on each side at this point in time. So while his prayer in verses 9 through 12 was a major step forward in his spiritual growth, and while there's nothing wrong with offering gifts, it's clear that Jacob still has more to learn about relying on God. And that brings us to one of the most unusual events recorded in the book of Genesis. And it starts with verse 22. Now he arose that same night and took his two wives and his two maids and his 11 children and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. And he took them and sent them across the stream, and he sent across whatever he had. Then Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. Well, that's sort of bizarre, is it not? You know, here he is left by himself. The Jabbok that is referred to here, it's a small river or a stream that flows from east to west into the Jordan River. And this ford or crossing place is near the land of Canaan. So he's getting near to crossing back over into Canaan. But then you come to verse 24 and it raises a lot of questions, doesn't it? Who is this man? And why were they wrestling? You know, there's no information given as to what prompted them to begin wrestling. And why would 97-year-old Jacob do this? Did you realize that he's 97 years old at this point in his life? You know, if you go back and you work the math regarding the lifespans of each of the individuals and when different individuals were born and you put the pieces together, you find out that the incident where Jacob stole his brother's blessing, he was 77 years old when that happened. And 20 years have passed. He's now 97 years old. And here he is wrestling. And why does this struggle continue all night? it really seems odd. Well, the way the passage is written suggests that Jacob initially did not know this man's identity. And that's why it just says here that he's a man. But as time went on, Jacob became increasingly aware. Let's read on. Verse 25. When he saw that he had not prevailed against him, he touched the socket of his thigh. So the socket of Jacob's thigh was dislocated while he wrestled with him. And then he said, "Let me go, for the dawn is breaking." But he said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." So he said to him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." He said, "Your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel. For you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed." Then Jacob asked him and said, "Please tell me your name." But he said, "Why is it that you ask my name?" And he blessed him there. So Jacob named the place Peniel, for he said, "I have seen God face to face, yet my life has been preserved." Now the sun rose upon him just as he crossed over Peniel, and he was limping on his thigh. Therefore, to this day, the sons of Israel do not eat the sinew of the hip, which is on the socket of the thigh, because he touched the socket of Jacob's thigh in the sinew of the hip. So again, Jacob's opponent is referred to as a man in verse 24. We've already seen that. And he seemed to have human limitations in that if you read the first half of verse 25, this man did not prevail against Jacob. And yet at the same time, we could see that he possessed enormous power and was able to dislocate Jacob's thigh with a mere touch. And that would certainly be a clear signal to Jacob that he's not dealing with any ordinary man here. And in fact, Jacob's refusal to let him go until he had blessed him is a clear indication that Jacob understood that he was, in fact, wrestling with God himself. He knew that he was in great peril with Esau heading toward him. Remember, Esau's on his way with these 400 men. Jacob knew that his life was in great jeopardy. And he knew that he needed the blessing of God. Now, we'd be correct in saying that Jacob's wrestling opponent was an angel, but he was not just any angel. This was the angel referred to elsewhere in the Old Testament as the angel of the Lord, that is, the pre-incarnate Christ. And if you turn to Hosea, Hosea is the first of the minor prophets. So if you go past Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, then you'll come to Hosea. Turn to chapter 12. Hosea makes a commentary on this particular event that helps shed some light on what's going on here. What Hosea does is he uses Jacob to illustrate a point, and we won't go into Hosea's whole argument, but if you just look at chapter 12, verse 3, it says, "In the womb he took his brother by the heel." So who's he referring to? Jacob. "And in his maturity he contended with God." He was wrestling with God. "Yes, he wrestled with the angel and prevailed. He wept and sought his favor. He found him at Bethel, and there he spoke with us. Even the Lord, the God of hosts, the Lord is his name." And so you can see that Hosea is identifying this angel who wrestled with Jacob. With the Lord himself, with Yahweh, with the Lord of hosts. So this is obviously an extremely unusual encounter that Jacob is having here. But the one thing that is crystal clear is that Jacob understands who his opponent is, and he understands the necessity of receiving a blessing from him. Jacob realizes that he is in great trouble, he is in great danger, and he needs the blessing of the Lord. Well, then the Lord asked Jacob to verbalize his name in verse 27. You notice he says, "So he said to him, 'What is your name?' And he said, 'Jacob.'" Jacob's name, of course, is tied to his character, as is so often the case in the Old Testament, where the meaning of the name reflects the character of the individual. And you remember the name Jacob. We talked about this some time ago. The name Jacob means heel grabber. It also means one who supplants. It refers to somebody who is a conniver, a deceiver. That's what his name means. And in effect, his name was a summary of his life and of his character. Remember, he had struggled with his brother while they were still in the room, still in the womb. That was in chapter 25, verse 22. Later, he took his brother's birthright, and then he took his brother's blessing. He deceived his father in order to obtain that blessing. So you can see his life is just characterized by struggle after struggle and supplanting and deceiving. He had contended with his father-in-law. You know, he and Laban weren't exactly best buddies with each other. He had played favorites with his wives. And you find that in the relationships with his wives, there's all kinds of conflict and contention. And now he had struggled with God himself and had prevailed. Obviously, because God allowed him to prevail. Again, it's God's grace. So in verse 28, the Lord declares to him, "Your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed." Well, the name Israel means God's fighter, or he struggles with God. And the idea is that Jacob has gone from tenaciously using human strength and human wits and human means in pursuing what he wants, to now tenaciously holding on to the Lord himself. Again, recognizing that the only one who matters is the Lord, and the only one whose blessing he must receive is the Lord's. He knows that he needs to be delivered, and it's only the Lord who can do that. And so this really marks a turning point in Jacob's thinking and in Jacob's life. And how did God bring about that change in him? How did God bring him to this point? It was through trouble. It was through trial. It's through this situation with Esau coming with 400 men. It's the pressure of trouble that causes him to stop depending solely on himself and to start depending on the Lord. Then it goes on in verse 29. It says, then Jacob asked him and said, please tell me your name. He said, well, you know, why is it that you ask my name? And he blessed him there. And then you'll notice that there's some memorials that are set up or some means of remembering this. Jacob named the place Peniel, for he said, I have seen God face to face. Again, an indication that Jacob knew exactly who he was wrestling with. Yet my life has been preserved. Now, obviously, he is not seeing God in his full glory. The scripture is clear that no one can look upon God and live. But he has been wrestling with the pre-incarnate Christ, the angel of the Lord. And so one way that Jacob wants to remember this act is by naming that place. And then it says, now the sun rose upon him just as he crossed over Penuel, and he was limping on his thigh. It's kind of another memorial, another way of remembering this event. This is something that Jacob was clearly going to take with him the rest of his life. He would be limping the rest of his life and would not fail to remember this particular encounter. And then in verse 32, it says, therefore, to this day, the sons of Israel do not eat the sinew of the hip, which is on the socket of the thigh, because he touched the socket of Jacob's thigh and the sinew of the hip. And so apparently there was a dietary rule that was established as a result of this event, too. Now, interestingly enough, it's not repeated in the law of Moses, but certainly at the very least, up until the time of Moses, this was an observance within Israel, that they would not eat this part of an animal. Well, again, according to verse 31, we saw that Jacob crossed the Jabbok at sunrise, where he rejoined his wives and their maids and his children. And you'll notice that it was not a moment too soon. Look at verse 1 of chapter 33. Then Jacob lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau was coming, and 400 men with him. So he divided the children among Leah and Rachel and the two maids. He put the maids and their children in front, and Leah and her children next, and Rachel and Joseph last. Any hint as to why that order? What does that suggest about his relationship with them? Notice the maids are first, and then comes Leah, and then comes Rachel. And it's kind of in order of where his heart was. Verse 3, but he himself passed on ahead of them and bowed down to the ground seven times until he came near to his brother. So, the moment of truth has arrived. How is Esau going to receive him? Is his prayer going to be answered? Did his plan work? At this point, he doesn't know that. But then we come to verse 4. Then Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. He lifted his eyes and saw the women and the children and said, who are these with you? So he said, the children whom God has graciously given your servant. Then the maids came near with their children, and they bowed down. Leah likewise came near with her children, and they bowed down. And afterward Joseph came near with Rachel, and they bowed down. And he said, what do you mean by all this company which I have met? And he said, to find favor in the sight of my Lord. But Esau said, I have plenty, my brother. Let what you have be your own. And Jacob said, no, please, if now I have found favor in your sight, then take my present from my hand, for I see your face as one sees the face of God, and you have received me favorably. Please take my gift, which has been brought to you, because God has dealt graciously with me, and because I have plenty. And then he urged him, and he took it. Well, obviously, Esau's reaction to Jacob could not have been more favorable, could it? I mean, it's really remarkable, his response in verse 4, when the two brothers are reunited after 20 years. Obviously, the grudge, the animosity appear to be completely gone. And you'll notice that Esau even declines the gifts. He says, I don't want to take all these things. You know, I have everything that I need. And yet Jacob insists that he take them, and ultimately Esau does. But notice the statement that Jacob makes in verse 10. What do you think the implication is of what he's saying here in verse 10? He says, "No, please, if now I have found favor in your sight, then take my present from my hand, for I see your face as one sees the face of God, and you have received me favorably." Any idea what he's saying there? That God answered his prayer. Yeah, he's really acknowledging, isn't he, that Esau, I can look in your face and I can see that there's been a change here. The animosity is gone. The grudge is gone. And he sees this as God's doing, God's answer to his prayer. Did he need to make all those plans? Did he need the gifts and all that? Probably not. Obviously, God has done a work in Esau's heart and has changed him. Well, then in verse 12, Esau makes Jacob an interesting offer. Verse 12, it says, "Then Esau said, 'Well, let us take our journey and go, and I will go before you.'" Sound like a good deal? Notice Jacob's response. "But he said to him, 'My Lord knows that the children are frail, and the flocks and herds which are nursing are a care to me. And if they are driven hard one day, all the flocks will die. Please let my Lord pass on before his servant, and I will proceed at my leisure, according to the pace of the cattle that are before me, and according to the pace of the children, until I come to my Lord at Seir.'" So what's Esau's offer? He's saying, "Hey, we're reunited. Let's stick together. Let's travel together." And Jacob think that's a good idea? Not really. Yeah, it seems like Jacob is still a little uneasy. He's still a little uncomfortable with his brother and does not really want to have the two of them together for fear that something might happen, something might go wrong. So he comes up with what's kind of a fairly lame excuse in verses 13 and 14. With that, you'll notice that Esau accepts that. He says in verse 15, "Esau said, 'Please let me leave with you some of the people who are with me.' But he said, 'What need is there? Let me find favor in the sight of my Lord.' So Esau returned that day on his way to Seir. And Jacob journeyed to Succoth and built for himself a house and made booths for his livestock. Therefore, the place is named Succoth, which means booths." So, they go their separate ways. Esau agrees that, okay, if you don't want to travel together, that's fine. And Esau turns around and he heads back south, back down to Seir, back down to Edom. And Jacob continues his journey toward the west, heading toward Canaan. And there he comes to a location where he builds for himself a house and settles there for a certain period of time. Well, after spending a period, you know, perhaps several years in Succoth, we don't really know exactly how much time, Jacob moves on to another location. He moves on to Shechem. And you'll find that in verses 18 through 20. It says, "Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, when he came from Padan Aram, and camped before the city, and bought the piece of land where he had pitched his tent from the hand of the sons of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. Then he erected there an altar and called it El Elohi Israel." And then that brings us to chapter 34. Now, chapter 34 is certainly one of those chapters that puts the ugliness of men's sinful hearts kind of on full display. It's kind of an atrocious act that we see displayed here, not a pleasant chapter at all. We will cover it rather quickly. In chapter 34, it says, verse 1, "Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Jacob, went out to visit the daughters of the land. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor the Hivite, the prince of the land, saw her, he took her and lay with her by force. He was deeply attracted to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the girl and spoke tenderly to her. So Shechem spoke to his father Hamor, saying, 'Get me this young girl for a wife.' Now Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah, his daughter, but his sons were with his livestock in the field. So Jacob kept silent until they came in. Then Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out to Jacob to speak with him. Now the sons of Jacob came in from the field when they heard it. And the men were grieved, and they were very angry because he had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, for such a thing ought not to be done. Well, it's very clear from these verses that no matter how much love Shechem felt for Dinah, you know, as is expressed here in verse 3, and no matter how tender his words were, what he did constituted rape, and it was an atrocious act. There's just no question about that. And that's certainly affirmed in verse 7, where that verse says in more than one way that this was a disgraceful thing, this was a horrible thing that had happened. Well, then the passage continues. Verse 8. But Hamor spoke with them, saying, "The soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him in marriage. Intermarry with us, give your daughters to us, and take our daughters for yourselves. Thus you shall live with us, and the land shall be open before you. Live and trade in it and acquire property in it." Shechem also said to her father and to her brothers, "If I find favor in your sight, then I will give whatever you say to me. Ask me ever so much bridal payment and gift, and I will give according as you say to me. But give me the girl in marriage." But Jacob's sons answered Shechem and his father Hamor with deceit, because he had defiled Dinah with their sister. They said to them, "We cannot do this thing to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a disgrace to us. Only on this condition will we consent to you, if you will become like us, in that every male of you be circumcised. Then we will give our daughters to you, and we will take your daughters for ourselves, and we will live with you and become one people. But if you will not listen to us to be circumcised, then we will take our daughters and go." Now their words seemed reasonable to Hamor and Shechem, Hamor's son. The young man did not delay to do the thing, because he was delighted with Jacob's daughter. Now he was more respected than all the household of his father. So Hamor and his son Shechem came to the gate of their city and spoke to the men of their city, saying, "These men are friendly with us, therefore let them live in the land and trade in it. For behold, the land is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters in marriage and give our daughters to them. Only on this condition will the men consent to us to live with us, to become one people, that every male among us be circumcised as they are circumcised. Will not their livestock and their property and all their animals be ours? Only let us consent to them, and they will live with us." All who went out to the gate of his city listened to Hamor and to his son Shechem, and every male was circumcised, all who went out of the gate of the city. Well, verse 23, if you caught that, it kind of reveals Hamor and Shechem's real motive in all of this. Now, certainly Shechem is drawn to Dinah. There's no question about that he desires her. But there's more going on than just that. Verse 23, what else are they after? Yeah, they're themselves. They're out to prosper. You know, they see this as an opportunity that, Jacob and his sons have great possessions, and they see this as a ticket to acquire what Jacob has, to get their hands on the blessings that Jacob has received. And obviously, it's at this point that things get really ugly. We've already seen that Jacob's sons are involved in deception, and in verse 25, it starts to become clear. Now, it came about on the third day when they were in pain that two of Jacob's sons, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, each took his sword and came upon the city unawares and killed every male. They killed Hamor and his son Shechem with the edge of the sword and took Dinah from Shechem's house and went forth. Jacob's sons came upon the slain and looted the city because they had defiled their sister. They took their flocks and their herds and their donkeys and that which was in the city and that which was in the field. And they captured and looted all their wealth and all their little ones and all their wives, even all that was in the houses. Then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, "You have brought trouble on me by making me odious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites. And my men, being few in number, they will gather together against me and attack me, and I will be destroyed, I and my household." But they said, "Should he treat our sister as a harlot?" Well, did you notice that it was Simeon and Levi who killed the men? And these are brothers of Dinah. They have the same mother. But while it was these two who did the killing, what did the other brothers do? They looted, didn't they? Yeah, so while the other brothers weren't actually involved in the murdering, They're certainly giving tacit approval to what Simeon and Levi have done here, because they don't hesitate to go in and to loot and to take everything that they can get their hands on. So it's really clear that the brothers are kind of all on the same page as far as this particular act is concerned. Well, obviously, Jacob is concerned about the reaction of the neighboring Canaanites and undoubtedly wondering, how is this event going to affect God's promise, the fulfillment of God's promise? And Jacob is fearful that the Canaanites are now going to turn and attack them and destroy them because they are small in number. And what's interesting here is that just as their father in his life, throughout his lifetime, had been so much characterized by taking swift action and making plans and relying on human wisdom and human viewpoint and human strength, now you see his sons doing the exact same thing, only kind of carrying it even a lot further to where they are so rash in what they've done. And their response to what undeniably is a terrible crime and deserves to be punished, but their response is just so over the top, and it's just so excessive. It really makes us kind of real when we read this and think, gosh, these 12 brothers are going to become, well, here it's the 11 brothers, are going to become the heads of the tribes of the nation of Israel. You know, these are the men that God is going to work with. You know, and again, as Rocky has reminded us multiple times, you know, who does God have to work with? Does he have anyone good to work with? No, he has people who are just like us. And he works with sinners, and he uses sinners, and he is gracious to sinners. And certainly we see that here. Now, we're going to see farther down the road in future weeks as we continue this our study of Genesis that there's going to be lasting repercussions to Simeon and to Levi, to their tribes. But it's amazing that God in his grace continues to use these brothers. When the mantle is passed from Jacob to the brothers, God just continues to use them in spite of their sin. He continues to be gracious to them. Well, in chapter 35, we won't take time to read it, but in the first four verses, I'll read verse 1. It says, "Then God said to Jacob, 'Arise and go up to Bethel and live there.'" So God here, at this point in time, makes a direct call to Jacob to pack up and head back to Bethel. And again, Jacob had made that oath to return. And so the Lord calls him to do exactly that. And the Lord calls him to make an altar there to worship. And so in the first four verses, it just discusses the fact that Jacob, in his call from the Lord to worship the Lord, knew that his family needed to prepare for that worship by getting rid of anything that was inappropriate or ungodly. And so there's a pursuit of holiness here in preparation for worship. And then in verses 5 through 15, this is really an amazing passage, as once again God speaks with Jacob and reaffirms to him that the promise still stands. And God repeats that same promise, that same blessing that was given to Isaac, was given to Abraham, and it is now his. That nothing has changed. The promise still stands in spite of the sinfulness of his sons. Let's see. Just a couple more comments. In chapter 35, if you look at verses 23 through 26, well, let me make a comment on verses 16 through 22. You'll notice here it talks about the journey from Bethel. When there was some distance to go, it says Rachel began to give birth, and she suffered severe labor. And obviously, this is the birth of the 12th son, Benjamin, and Rachel dies in childbirth. Then in verse 22, there's a comment made about Reuben. It's one of these verses that you wonder, well, what's this doing in here? And again, it's just a reminder of the sinfulness of man. In this case, it's Reuben's sin that is highlighted. And again, it will have implications for him in the future as well. And then you come to verses 23 through 26, and now we have all 12 of the sons representing the 12 tribes of Israel, and they are all named in these verses. And then Isaac comes to the end of his life. Verse 27, Jacob came to his father Isaac at Mamre in Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac had sojourned. Now the days of Isaac were 180 years. Isaac breathed his last and died and was gathered to his people, an old man of ripe age. And his sons Esau and Jacob buried him. And so here again, you see the two brothers are together. Interestingly enough, remember what Esau had vowed, that once his father died, that was when he was going to kill his brother. Clearly, that doesn't happen because Esau's heart has been changed by the Lord. Then chapter 36, again, we won't take time to read the chapter, but it's basically a genealogy. And what it does is it gives a listing of Esau's descendants. And, of course, Esau became the kingdom of Edom, and the kings of Edom are listed here. There's also a listing of the genealogy of the Horites, who were the inhabitants of the land of Seir, the land of Edom, prior to Esau settling there. And, you know, why are all these names listed? Why is all this in chapter 36? Well, it just kind of underscores the fact that God himself had said, you remember when Rebekah had the two sons who were wrestling in her womb? And the reason that was happening was because there were two nations within her. And so we see the fulfillment of that, that Esau has indeed become a nation by the grace of God. It's not a nation that's under the promise of God, and it's not a nation that knows God or reveres God. And in fact, later on, it would become a great enemy of Israel. But the Lord is true to his word, and Esau does become a great nation. So, what do we take away from these chapters? Well, again, you know, we see in Jacob's life, for the first 97 years, Jacob was quite content in his own schemes, in his own plans, and in his own strength, and in his own self-reliance. And, you know, I think he would have been happy to stay there. But what was it that marked a turning point in his life? It's when he began to be under severe pressure. It's when he began being under a threat, even a threat to his life, the threat of facing Esau, potentially losing not only everything that he owned and everything that was important to him, but even his own life. And when he was under that pressure, that's when he saw the absolute necessity of God's blessing. And when he wrestled with that fact, literally, he came to know God in a real and vital way that he had never experienced before. And when you think about it, you know, isn't that true for each of us? You know, when you think about the periods of time in your life when things are relatively easy and everything's kind of falling into place, I don't know if you're like me, but I find it so easy to get complacent and to get lazy in my prayer life and to just kind of start relying on myself and relying on my own strength. But boy, when trouble comes, when difficulties come, it drives us to our knees, doesn't it? And that's the time when spiritual growth takes place. That's the time when God begins building our character. And that's why the tribulations and trials are not a bad thing, but they're the very thing that should cause us to rejoice, because they are the tools that the Lord uses to teach us about himself. That's certainly what we see in Jacob's life, and it's certainly true in our own lives. So with that, let's turn to the Lord in prayer, and we'll be dismissed. Father, again, we thank you for your word, and we thank you for what you teach us here, just through the life of Jacob and all that he went through, all that he experienced. And Father, we can see so clearly in our own lives the necessity of relying on you and not on ourselves. And we can see the benefit of trials and troubles and difficulties because they drive us to you. And Father, that is exactly where we want to be. And so, Father, I pray that you would teach us to count these things as joy and to rejoice in what you're doing, even though sometimes it's a painful process. Father, we are grateful that you hold on to us, that you don't let us go, even though just like Jacob, just like Jacob's sons, we are often sinful and rebellious and do things that grieve your heart. Yet you hold on to us and just continue to extend your grace to us. And Father, for that, we are eternally grateful. We do thank you for this time that we've had together, and we just pray that you'll help us to recall these things, to bring them back to our memories as events transpire even this week.
And Father, we give you the praise in Jesus' name. Amen.